Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. Today's guest is someone with a really amazing life story, Tim Sheehy. He's a 2008 Naval Academy graduate who completed deployments as a Navy SEAL in Iraq, Afghanistan, South America, and the Pacific, where he earned multiple combat decorations, including the Bronze Star with Valor for Heroism in Combat and the Purple Heart. After leaving the Navy, he became a successful entrepreneur and founded Bridger Aerospace, an aerial firefighting company based in Montana. The company utilizes airborne surveillance tactics from the military to help put out wildfires. The company recently went public, earning a valuation of $869 million. And Tim is not only the CEO, but also an active firefighter pilot. He's written a book about his journey in the aerial firefighting industry, Mudslingers, which is linked in the show notes. And he's also currently running for Senate in Montana in what's going to be one of the more competitive races in 2024. Lastly, before we jump into this conversation, I'd like to note that although Tim is currently running for Senate, this is just a conversation with him to learn more about his experiences. And our publishing of this conversation does not constitute departmental or institutional endorsement of the specific views that he presents. So with no further ado, I hope you enjoy. Tim, welcome to the show. It's such a delight to have you on.
Thanks for taking the time to have me, Annika.
Just to kick us off here, there are a lot of really interesting things about your biography, but I'm going to kind of skip to the more recent. You were a Navy SEAL, and when you decided to leave the SEALs, join the private sector, plenty of industries would love to hire a Navy SEAL. I know if I had a job that I needed done and someone said, I've got a Navy SEAL on it, I would have a lot of confidence that that job was going to actually get done. And instead, you decided to take a much more difficult path and to start a business from scratch. Why?
Well, I think there is anyone who has joined the military in any capacity, but especially folks that join, you know, the elite units where tremendous effort, screening, pain are involved in joining those organizations, you know, the Rangers, Green Berets, SEALs, Marines, you know, the aviation community. There's a deep sense of mission and purpose that goes with that. And I think that, you know, when people ask me, or you know, friends of mine who are obviously, you know, ecosystem of military is we're all friends, get asked, you know, yeah, there are oftentimes various answers of patriotism and, you know, sense of duty, but really, I think it's almost like a biological desire to be part of something greater than yourself. You really want to be part of a mission, and you want to know that every day when you put your boots and your uniform on, you're serving a higher purpose. And I think especially in 21st century America, you know, with the kind of decline of religion, the decline of social organizations, you know, families are getting smaller. In some cases, we barely have families anymore. You know, we're at the highest rates of fatherlessness in the history of this country. You know, there's a void in so many young people's lives for a higher purpose. And I think the military is a great opportunity for folks to achieve that. But, you know, in my particular sense, you know, I had zero business experience, zero finance experience. Zero. I couldn't read a P&L. I didn't know how to do my taxes. But, you know, I'd been wounded and injured in the military and was no longer able to medically be a SEAL. And it was clear that if I was going to be able to stay in the military, it would likely have been in another capacity. And for me, that just didn't hold much interest. If I couldn't lead my men on missions, I wanted to move on to something else. And I saw at that time, this is 2014 timeframe, that, you know, we were still – you know, context is always important in everything. And, you know, there was still kind of an economic malaise in the United States. There was still this recovery happening from the Great Recession. And I think, you know, there was also a sense of duty there where, number one, hey, you know, creating jobs and building a business is important. And for me, I had a kind of unusual skill set where I had grown up in aviation. I'd been a pilot since I was a kid. My neighbor growing up was a Korean War Navy pilot, and he taught me how to fly. So I loved aviation. And I'd seen, you know, the application of aerial surveillance technology and close air support during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, saw how life-saving it could be when used properly, how dangerous it could be when used improperly. You know, the largest killer of troops in the first Gulf War of American troops was ourselves, and oftentimes our own air support. And that goes back all the way to World War II. The integration of an aircraft with a ground team in combat is very challenging to do effectively and safely. So I'd been the recipient and beneficiary of tremendously effective air support, both surveillance as well as kinetic, and decided to start a company, to try to bring that capability to other areas. And at the time, many folks don't remember this event, but in 2013, there was an event called the Yarnell Fire in Arizona. They made a movie about it called Only the Brave. And the Granite Mountain Hotshots, 19 of them, the entire team was burned alive, killed. Mm. And the team leader of that team that day made the right decision with the wrong information. And, they thought the fire was doing one thing. When shifted, he led his team, into a box canyon, and the fire did something else, and they all died. And, when I heard about that event and started to understand the implications of it, I realized that had that team leader had what I had had on the ground in Afghanistan, they'd still be alive. So I started Bridger Aerospace with the vision of taking a capability that we'd used to great effect during the war and trying to apply it to other things in America, in this case, wildfire, that really needed that support. I mean, there were other applications, as well, border security, law enforcement, search and rescue, but wildfire became our core mission. And, what greater duty can veterans fulfill? We were an all-veteran founding team. All combat veterans started this company from scratch in our barn, total bootstrap. It was all risk, all on black. But to take things we learned during the war and continue to serve America with them. So, at the time, I'm not going to lie, there wasn't a whole lot of high-minded rhetoric. It was simply, hey, this is a cool idea. Let's see if we can make it work. And, it was touch and go for the first couple of years, to be honest. I mean, starting any business from scratch is really tough. And I can't, my wife and I talk about it almost daily. She was a Marine Corps officer, so we both served in the war. And we're like, man, looking back on those days, I'm 38 now. If I had to go back in time and talk to my 28-year-old self and say, I'd be like, hey, man, what you're about to do is so risky. There are so many pitfalls. Would I do the same thing? I don't know. But I hope I would, because it's been an amazing journey.
Mm. And one of the things that's really remarkable about your business, I mean, there's a lot of discussion on how to handle, encouraging entrepreneurship in America writ large right now. And I mean, the truth is there's been a lot of focus on business, but a lot of it's been things that are, in bits, things that aren't as physical as the kind of stuff that you have built. It helps local communities quite a bit more to have, both in terms of actually setting out the wildfires that threaten local communities, but even in terms of jobs and stuff, it's more actually kind of helpful for the community to have something physical than to have, yet another dating app. Do you have any thoughts on kind of the particular challenges that come with building an actual brick and mortar business and how, from a policy standpoint, we could encourage more of that kind of entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head. And so few people understand that distinction. So thank you for understanding it and highlighting it, because you're absolutely right. It's and I tell people a lot, we've created over 400 jobs in the last several years. Again, Bridger Aerospace is our core business for aerial firefighting. But through that, we've created a number of spin-off companies, many of which have also been extremely successful in manufacturing, electronics manufacturing, software development, agriculture, aviation logistics. And to your point, people are used to hearing these startup stories. Oh boy, Facebook started, Google started, whatever. And I tell people, listen, we're not making yoga pants and dating apps here at Bridger Aerospace. We are flying big aircraft in hazardous conditions, protecting people. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at the amount of jobs at a manufacturing business. At one point, we had about 100 plus employees in a manufacturing business. We sold that a few years ago. It kind of grew up out of our realm of ability. It became very big and very successful, so we sold it. Manufacturing jobs, a business like ours that owns and operates, a large fleet of aircraft, hundreds of employees that are doing maintenance, fabrication, manufacturing, accounting, finance. I mean, the downstream supply chain impact of having a business that mm-hmm. does hard things, to your point, I mean, it creates sticky careers. It creates, for every job here, depending on how far you want to, look at the plume, there are 4, 5, 6 jobs downstream that are created. We build our campus here. Those are construction jobs. We buy components, we buy, whether it's technology or sheet metal fabrication, or we contract out functions. I mean, manufacturing companies and companies that do hard things with actual objects, as you said, create a downstream impact on the local economy that that is very positive and also, like I said, very sticky. So, that's an important distinction. And especially, I think, in an age in America when you know, many people are very pessimistic about the future of our economy. They're pessimistic about, hey, you know, can the American dream survive? And I think there's so much to discuss there and unpack, not the least of which is the ability of the American workforce to work. We've incentivized, you know, three generations of young Americans, and we've indoctrinated them that if you work with your hands when you grow up, you're a failure. You know, you should go to college and get a degree in, you know, underwater basket weaving and gender studies. And you know, no matter how much debt you have to take out to pay for that degree, you're doing the right thing. You're doing just get the degree, get as many degrees as possible, regardless of whether there's a job on the other side of it, regardless of whether if the job you get can actually pay for that degree. And then, you know, in some cases, entire families are being indebted in this case. Whereas, you know, you look at so many of our trades right now, which frankly have been betrayed by our government, by our industries. And, you know, these skills that built America, welders, sheet metal, diesel mechanics, plumbers, pipe fitters, you know, these key skills that we now can't find, electricians, carpenters. I mean, these are skills that we desperately need in a growing economy, and we can't find them. And these are the type of jobs that we employ, and we're very proud to do it. And you know, we've directly invested in community college trade school programs, because when we put up a job rec for, you know, a avionics technician or airframe and power plant mechanic, you know, it can be very hard to find the necessary skills. So, you know, it's time to get America back to work. It's time to make sure that young men, young women, as early as middle school and high school, they're exposed to shop class, they're exposed to, you know, mechanic class, they're exposed to all the skills early on, because not everyone's designed to go to college for 4 years and get a degree in philosophy. And I think our student loan programs, our Department of Education, our entire education industrial complex, from college counselors, you know, all the way through these education summer camps and AP classes and extracurricular activities, it's all designed to put our kids on a conveyor belt at age six and ensure that they get a master's degree. Whether or not that's good for them or good for the country or good for their families, that's what we're doing. And I'm not anti-education at all, quite the opposite. But education, you know, has shifted from Western education used to be about asking the right questions, and now it's about shoving answers down everyone's throat as early as possible. Memorize the answers, get the best test scores, do the best AP classes, go extracurricular, get in the best school, get in the best degree, instead of saying, what's the point of education? It's to create educated and enlightened, capable citizens of our nation who can take our country to the next level. And all those matters, I think we've been failing a couple of generations of Americans. And it's about time we incentivize, you know, the trades, vocational work, building a business and starting a business. And it's really hard to start a business if you are carrying $200,000 of student debt on your back. It's very hard to start a business if you've been kind of indoctrinated in the rat race from day one that, hey, follow these steps to prosperity, because entrepreneurship is in and of itself a question. It's not about the answers, like, you know, take your test to become a lawyer, take your test to become an investment banker, take your test to become, you know, you name the kind of careerist job. Entrepreneurship is always a question. And every business I've started, which there have been several, never have we done precisely the mission we thought we would when we started. There's always pivots. There's always evolution, and that comes from asking the right questions and actually seeking answers, not assuming you know the answer at the beginning and driving your way to that answer. It's asking the right questions and letting the process of learning the answers be the journey.
So your education came through the military, and that, I think, is another really interesting example of the trend that you're talking about, because historically, the military was a really, really essential piece of America's social fabric. I mean, I come from a military family, many, many generations, everyone served, and yet there's been a real loss of confidence, not just in our military ability, but also in our military culture in general, and as a result, our military recruitment has been quite poor. Do you have any thoughts, especially as a combat veteran, on if and how we can restore that trust in the American military?
Well, short answer is yes, and we can. I think I'm a student of history. I'm not a historian. I don't have a PhD. I'm not Dr. Tim or anything like that. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in history from the Naval Academy. Because if you go to the Naval Academy, everything is engineering based. The core curriculum at Naval Academy is science and engineering. But, you know, lifelong avid reader, you know, obsessive historian, you know, just always reading. In fact, I just finished a great book called Astoria, which I encourage you to read. It's about the founding of the Northwestern Territories of America, Oregon, Washington, and all the amazing, just incredible stories that went into that. Terrible, terrible tragedies, but incredible entrepreneurship, because essentially the Northwestern Territories in the United States were discovered and settled by private industry. It wasn't government. Right. It wasn't, you know, but that's another topic. but I guess my point is, with that historical perspective, you know, we've been here before with our military. And I think, you know, we've become this culture of such, you know, junk food in what we consume. You know, everything's a soundbite. Everything's a tweet. Everything's a TikTok video. Everything's shorter, the better, simpler. And I think that's contributed to the degradation of so many things in America, because, you know, deep issues like this, you know, American people are owed a discussion about these issues. They're owed a fulsome evaluation of what these issues mean. I think with our military thing, you know, everyone wants to call it woke, DEI, this crap. And that's all true, just to be clear. I believe that is true. But, you know, when put in context, we've gone through many periods in American history where the military has frankly been, you know, in disarray. And the American people have not really respected it. I mean, look at the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, the Zumwalt Navy, as we called it, the Navy, when, you know, it was sideburns and bell bottoms, and, you know, the fads that he was pushing, trying to make the Navy cool again, you know, are to this day a subject of mockery.
Sorry. Wait, did they have bell bottoms in the Navy to make the Navy? I did not know this.
Well, yeah, well, look up the Zumwalt Navy. I mean, I'm making light of things again. I'm doing what I just mentioned, which is sound bites. But, you know, the Zumwalt Navy is often looked on it with great derision by the modern day Navy, because essentially during a time like now of great recruiting challenges, the draft was you know, there were mutinies on board ships. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, people were fragging each other, you know, in combat in Vietnam, Americans killing Americans. I mean, it was a disaster. It was a terrible period. And the Zumwalt Navy, obviously I went to the Naval Academy, I was a naval officer, you know, is kind of the when people say that, that's the offhand comment to refer to a very dark time in the U.S. Navy. The interwar period between World War I and II was a terrible time in the U.S. Army. When, you know, it was basically, you know, regarded as a jobs program for guys who couldn't get anything else, you know, in life. During the Depression, it was a good deal to have a military paycheck, so people didn't have a great degree of respect for it. You know, and we can go through a lot of these periods back through our nation's history and all the way to the beginning. Let's not forget, I mean, our Constitution, our nation was formed with an extremely skeptical view of a standing military. I mean, in the Constitution, the Army is only supposed to be a provisional force that exists for basically 2 years to fight a war and then go away, because they did not want a standing army because they felt it would be a tool of a tyrannical government. And our Navy, which was regarded as essential by some of our founders, was a topic of incredible caustic debate in the earliest years of America when, you know, should precious taxpayer money be funded on a Navy or not? And you know, I won't go into that whole discussion. It's a fascinating period of history, memorialized in a book called Six Frigates by Ian Toll. And although it's a naval history book, it's such a looking glass into the early debates of a constitutional republic. But where I'm going with this is yes, we're in a tough time with the military, no question. You know, we've effectively lost two wars, which I'll be very clear. Let's be very clear. The military won those wars. I don't care what anybody says. Iraq and Afghanistan were won by the United States military. Those countries were stabilized, and the military did its job. And in both cases, the Obama-Biden, you know, I want to get super political here, but it's just a fact. The Obama-Biden, you know, cabal of policymakers decided to end those conflicts in an extremely irresponsible way. So we ended Iraq, and of course, within 3 years, ISIS had blossomed into the most barbaric terrorist organization in the world, and we had to go back in for the third time in 25 years and invade Iraq for a third time to get rid of ISIS. Afghanistan was effectively stabilized, and it only would take, you know, a small security force to prop up the Afghan government to make sure that Afghanistan did not devolve into a terrorist safe haven yet again. And that's exactly what they did. And you know, and of course, the discussion there is, oh, well, we had to bring the troops home. Well, no one's talking about bringing troops over from South Korea. We've been there for 75 years holding the 38th parallel. No one's talking to bring them home from Kuwait. We've been there for 30 years. No one's talking to bring home Japan and Germany. We've been there since the end of World War II. American troops have been stationed around the world holding up, you know, the world order for a long time. And so it's frustrating that has cast aspersions on the military, but it has. And frankly, it's fair that, that people look at that and say, why the hell? And my wife and I talk about this. She's also an Afghan combat vet. We say, are we going to encourage our kids to join? Because the wars we fought in, you know, our sacrifice and that of my team, you know, I was wounded in combat. I had teammates wounded, killed in combat, you know, and then their sacrifice was literally washed down the drain and dishonored by the highest level of government. So it's hard to convince people to join, risk their lives, convince people to have their children join, risk their lives for a government that has very clearly shown it's not really going to take that seriously and it might give it up. And then, of course, couple that with all this other, you know, woke crap, I'll call it, where, you know, the military is supposed to have one purpose, close with, kill the enemy, and advance our national policy via, you know, as von Clausewitz said, war is politics, you know, continued by other means. And right now, it's as we all know, it's being used more of a social marketing tool than anything else.
We are unfortunately pushing up on time a little bit here, but I definitely want to have the chance to ask you a little bit about your Senate race. So you are running for Senate in the state of Montana. And one of the things that's really, I mean, as I think we've discussed a little before the interview, I have pretty, you know, family connections to the state of Montana. But one of the things that's very interesting to me about this run is the way that it will affect, you know, the state of the Senate 10, you know, 5-10 years down the line. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, why this particular race is going to have such a big impact on the state of the Senate and the state of the country.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a politics, you know, like entrepreneurship. I plan to do a career in the military. I never saw myself in politics. I started a company in my barn with my wife. And then, you know, 10 years on, now politics is in our future, or it's in our present day, I should say. And, you know, just it's a strange world in politics, as you know. I mean, everything is just hyper politicized. There's no room for logical discussion about solving the very serious problems we're facing as a country. You know, and for me, my entry into politics was accidental in the most purest form. It was really when I watched Kabul fall in 2021, and I was just absolutely disgusted at the American citizens we left behind, at our allies we left behind, and you know, me and so many of my friends, you know, we spent so much of our own money and time getting civilians out, getting allies out of there to safety before they got their heads cut off and families were raped and murdered, and it was a tremendously challenging, terrible time for us veterans who served there. Most Americans barely remember it. They're like, oh yeah, the Afghan thing, whatever. But for those of us who served there, it was an incredibly, it was just deeply shameful, angering, and emotionally wrenching. So, you know, I came out the back of that and I'd never been political prior to that. And I didn't like come out and run for office, but I started getting involved in politics. And I'll be very frank, I was extremely frustrated and angry at the Biden administration and anyone who supported their efforts that literally dishonored our nation's longest war and squandered 20 years of hard fought sacrifice. And in that, I started to become a surrogate speaker and donor just for Republican causes. Again, someone who wasn't overtly political, but simply said, I cannot stand by and watch this happen again. You know, Biden's been involved in two of our most disastrous, you know, pullouts in Iraq and Afghanistan. He architected both of them. And so that's when I started getting involved. And of course, unbeknownst to me, you know, folks were watching and said, hey, you know, you're pretty good at this. You know, you're an effective speaker. You have a great life story. You know, it's about time we stopped sending career politicians to D.C. And, you know, would you be interested in running? And of course, my answer was absolutely not. You know, I don't want to get in this crap. This is crazy, you know. But, you know, after being asked to consider it and saying no, my wife really is one that pulled me inside and said, hey, you know, you have to do this. You don't want to, and I don't want to. It's going to, as you've probably seen in the press, they're going to tear us apart, destroy our life. You know, everything you've ever done, all the philanthropy, they're going to turn you into a monster. Even though you all you've ever done is serve your country and serve a community. It's like, but you know, if you don't do this and the country continues to go off the rails, it's like, you won't be able to sleep for the rest of your life. If you've been given an opportunity, frankly, to step in and save America and you don't take that opportunity, and things get worse and go off the rails, you'll never forgive yourself. And therefore it was truly a call of duty that we answered. And, you know, obviously half the country won't agree with that, but it is what it is. We're in this for the right reasons. And this race, as you correctly stated, is the race that will determine control of the Senate. You know, and the Senate is intentionally structural. It's glacial in nature. It's not, you know, the presidency is important no matter who wins the presidency. But let's be honest, the president shows up, issues executive orders. You know, there's 3 to 4 years of impact, and then the next guy shows up and he undoes them all. You know, it's the tide coming in and coming out. Important, no question. But in modern day America, you know, that's just how it works. Whereas the Senate, it was built by our framers, as you know, from the James Madison Institute. You know, the Senate was built to be a glacial body that frankly protected, you know, America's institutions and ensured that we didn't do anything too crazy in the House of Representatives or the White House or even the judicial branch. It's meant to be, you know, the force of stability. And therefore, whatever it does has long-term impacts. And, you know, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, you know, Socialist, the simple fact is, you know, the Democrats have made clear that their intent, this isn't rhetoric, but, you know, the Democrats have just made clear, this is just fact, they want to eliminate the filibuster. That's what they want to do. And if you don't believe it, you know, ask Kyrsten Sinema. She's effectively been pushed out of her party, the Democrat Party, and forced to become an independent. Because she said, I am not going to support eliminating the filibuster. That's a key hallmark of the structural manner in which the Senate operates. And let's not forget, Harry Reid did that for judicial nominees, you know, 51 votes, you know, a while back. And then they want to do it for everything now. And if they do that, that means they've stated they intend to add two more states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, which build in a permanent Democrat majority for, you know, at least a decade, if not longer. And then they want to pack the Supreme Court, which has been, you know, frankly, a Democrat goal since FDR. And those are just stated facts. And if those things happen, you know, that has a generational impact on the future of America. That basically cements single-party rule for a generation. And there's no arguing that. And for me, that's unacceptable, especially after, you know, I personally was so viscerally impacted by this disaster in Afghanistan and the sacrifice that, you know, I was just with a buddy of mine from Afghanistan the other day. He has no legs, you know, all the way up to his hips. You know, and I was there with him when he lost him. And, you know, it's like the sacrifice he made, and he's home alive. You know, we had friends that didn't come home. And you know, I refuse to watch our country get sold out any further. I refuse to watch working class Americans be put under extreme inflation, you know, be lied to every day. I refuse to watch our national security interests on the world stage continue to be undermined by our own government. I continue to refuse to watch our border be wide open. I want immigrants to come here. I've brought dozens of immigrants to this country, whether they're Afghan refugees or workers coming to work for our company. We want people to move here the right way. But what we're doing at the border now, by any stretch of anyone's imagination, is extremely irresponsible. It's irresponsible from a national security perspective. It's irresponsible from a economic perspective. And this race will determine control of the Senate. So at the end of all that, you know, soliloquy I just gave you there, you know, this race will determine whether the Senate, you know, allows an expanded Supreme Court, allows two more states, wipes away the filibuster and cements a permanent single party rule, or whether we continue to be a constitutional republic. That's what's at stake. And that's why I'm running.
Okay. Well, I know that you have somewhere else to be, but thank you so much for your time. This has been super interesting.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. I mean, it's so important, you know, again, we are a constitutional republic. So it's so important that, you know, younger Americans start understanding what undergirds this country, you know, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, you know, and also all the documents around that are often forgotten, the Federalist Papers, the Articles of Confederation, the wisdom in those documents and the people that authored them, to include James Madison, are something that, you know, too many Americans are no longer familiar with. So thank you for continuing to enlighten Americans with that message.
Thank you so much, Tim. Well, there you have it, Madisonians, Tim Sheehy. If you enjoyed this discussion, his book is linked in the show notes, as is his webpage. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe to Madison's Notes. And to find out more about the James Madison Program and what we do here on Princeton's campus, you can go to jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can sign up for our mailing list, you can see our schedule of upcoming events, and you can also have access to recordings of all of the previous events that we've had this year. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next time here on Madison's Notes.